Season's greetings, y'all. Like Andy Williams said, it's the most wonderful time of the year. Christmas lights are up on all the houses. Family is in from out of town. And best of all, Starbucks is selling their seasonal drinks. Not a sponsor. But seriously, in between viewings of Jingle All the Way and Home Alone and hearing All I Want for Christmas for the thousandth time at the grocery store, wouldn't I do enjoy some of the more traditional songs of the season? Be they carols, hymns, or other songs in the Christian tradition, we're going to dive into our top 10 favorite religious Christmas songs today on Two Dudes and Tunes. Listening to Two Dudes and Tunes, the show where two dudes groove on Yuletide tunes. I'm full of eggnog and gingerbread. I'm Chris. My co-host sits in his chair of cheer in the hill country, and his name is Wood. Wood, I was curious, this being the Christmas season and all, what are some of the most memorable Christmas gifts you've ever received? They could be good memorable or bad memorable. And I don't want you necessarily to... don't throw any coworkers.
Family.
Don't throw any family. They feel like coworkers some days, don't they?
It's the best of times. It was the worst of times.
You don't have to name names is what I'm saying, but good, bad, or indifferent, what are some memorable presents that you've received?
Christmas has always been a really special time in my family, and I'm like for most people, I assume, who grew up in a fairly stable house. And so I've actually been really blessed over the years. I've had some pretty cool gifts. I remember wanting rollerblades when I was about six, which, I mean, the nice 90s, folks. That is wild.
Yeah, that is only 90s kids will remember.
One year, and it was a big deal, man. Like, rollerblades were the gift.
Mm-hmm.
Then one year I wanted a PS3, and my parents got it for me, which was surprising, but... the first gift that came to mind when you asked me this question was when I was probably about 10, I really wanted a train set. And my parents had taken me to a bunch of like train shows, which are a thing, and done a whole bunch of stuff with trains. And I was just awe-inspired every time we saw a train. You know, you and I get frustrated nowadays, I'm sure, when a train slows us down on our commutes or whatever. But as a little kid, that was the greatest thing that could happen to me.
Oh, yeah.
And so I remember asking for a particular train set, and my parents saying, no, you can't have it, blah, 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 blah. And then Dad pulled that whole trick of, you know, oh, wait, there's one more present on Christmas morning. You know, we're all done here. Uh-huh. And out came this big box. And I opened it up, and it was a Lionel 027 gauge steam train set that I had wanted, which is a large gauge.
That
train
is awesome.
With like a working smokestack and everything. And
that is too cool.
I loved this train set. It became something that I had. It was set up in my room all the time. I had it always going. It was just a big deal to me. And I had dozens of add-on cars and all of that. And then as I grew older and it took up too much space in my room or whatever, it became something that we brought out at Christmas and put up around the Christmas tree. And then on, you know, Christmas Eve, we'd put the train away to put the presents out.
That's awesome.
I'm 33 years old and I still have that train set today. And I still play with it every time we set it up. We didn't decorate for Christmas this year. And so I didn't get to put the train out and I really miss it. So, talk about a great gift. Here I am 25 years later and I still have it and I still play with it. So,
if you're talking about like dollars per hour, you have long since paid for that gift. That's too funny.
The worst Christmas gift I ever got, and it's just one of those stupid funny stories, you had to be there to get it or whatever. All kids hate getting clothes. Uh-huh. And I remember one year getting this shirt from my grandmother, my Nana, and it was deep red, think like rusty red for those people above the Mason-Dixon line. But if you're from Lubbock, that shirt could only be one thing, and that is a dirt red shirt.
Yeah, yeah.
And my grandmother cried when I called it a dirt red shirt. So yeah, that's probably the worst Christmas when I accidentally made my grandmother, my Nana cry. But what about you? What was your best and worst?
So I have, you know, I was thinking about it. There are not a ton of bad Christmas gifts. But in particular, one year I have some relatives who ran like an online Christian bookstore. And they brought a bunch of overstock that they were trying to get rid of in a big basket and said, "You guys just pick what you want." And then I feel bad even bringing it up because they're very sweet people, but there was like Bible themed crossword software for Windows 95. And
did you have a Windows 95 at the time?
No, this was in the middle 2000s, ooh, maybe even the middle 2010s.
Ooh.
And so that has always stuck out to me as like not well intentioned, but not, not what I would call good gift giving, I have to say. But I don't know. That's probably uncharitable of me. But for in the like good column, there are just tons and tons. I'm very blessed to have received a lot of really good gifts. My uncle in particular is really good at gift giving. So a couple years of ago, he got everybody the same thing. There was a coworker in his office who made these little like soup bowl covers for if you warm up your food, you know, instead of like burning your hands on a bowl, you just stick the bowl in this cloth cover. And they were all made of different fabrics. So like I got one that had like a space pattern on it. And I know that that sounds really small, but if you know me and my family, like food is our love language.
Look at me. It is my life, not just my love language. You're speaking my language right now.
But so no joke, at every family get together we have, we talk about other meals that we've had that were delicious, because pretty much all we ever do when we go on vacation is eat. So that was something he got all of us that like I to this day I will heat up leftovers for lunch, you know, during a work day and use it. But when I was a little kid, I was into G.I. Joe's, and he bought me this like commemorative anniversary edition G.I. Joe that came in a large, it wasn't cardboard, but this large facsimile of a book that had, you know, the first G.I. Joe box art on it. And he had real simple clothes, you know, it was like a replica. And I really, at the time, I really liked it. I feel sad that I didn't take care of it as you did your train, because it probably would be worth something, you know, even just being an anniversary edition. But so that is something that sticks out to me. And then my wife and I have been doing this thing the past few years where it's kind of hard to surprise your spouse with something, especially when she is the like financial wizard and you are not, because it's going to, whatever you buy is going to pop up on your like online banking app. And so we just kind of buy whatever we want personally for ourselves. And then we'll go to like Walmart and the dollar store and keep our stocking stuffers a secret and buy like really silly, goofy stuff. So like last year I bought her a couple of Nerf guns for us to like shoot at each other. She bought me all of Quantum Leap because it was something we had joked about watching, and then it popped up in my stocking. I bought her the movie Tenet, and I realize none of those things are particularly silly, but like we'll look for like cheap, crappy toys in the dollar section at Walmart. Yeah. So like I bought
little
her, like,
army men with parachutes.
Yeah, like a can of slime. I think she's gotten me a rubber dinosaur before. Just like really stupid stuff. And it's always a lot of fun. And we'll occasionally throw in serious stuff too. Like she got me some beard oil a couple of years ago that I still use because, you know, you don't use that much.
It goes a long way. A dabble do you.
It does. It really does. And so those are kind of, those are the gifts that have always stuck out in my mind as being memorable. There are a lot of them. We could go on and have like an episode just about gifts. Okay. Because it sounds like you and I had pretty good childhoods and received a lot of filthy lucre.
Oh yeah. As,
kids. But anyway, those are mine. Do we want to pivot from good gifts to good songs?
Yeah. Well, before we do that, I just kind of wanted to see what was going on with your life this holiday season right quick.
Oh yeah.
Cause it's been a couple weeks since we've talked. What's new with you?
Man, so my brother is in town. He lives in Nebraska. Usually he moved there earlier this year to take up a new job. And so he's in town for this whole month, which is really nice. My parents graciously waited to put up their Christmas tree until he got into town so that we could all decorate it. And so we got together and we had a brunch that consisted more food talk consisted entirely of spicy sausage balls, which are my favorite, pigs in a blanket, and pull apart like monkey bread is what my dad calls it, but basically like biscuits and cinnamon sugar,
lots
and
of butter,
pecans. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Sounds delightful.
Yeah. Oh man. I ate pretty much that whole Saturday. I just kind of grazed. And so by the time we got to dinner, I was like, I do not need a single thing for dinner because I have just like slowly but surely eaten every 45 minutes or half hour or whatever it was. And so that's really been it. We haven't, my wife and I have been watching Christmas movies. Like we watched National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation yesterday, which is,
so good.
A brand new favorite of mine. Growing up, we didn't ever watch it because it's a little off color and it's not my parents' sense of humor. And so they were like, oh, that's a bad movie. And so I kind of grew up with that, like, oh, that's a dumb movie. And I realized like 2 or 3 years ago, I'd never seen it. And Megan was like, you haven't seen that?
It's one of the greatest movies ever made.
Oh man. It's so funny. I cackle every year at that movie because it's so hilarious.
It's one of those movies I've probably seen 500 times in my life. Not gonna lie, like we watched it a couple of times every Christmas season, and every time I watch it, I see something new to laugh at. Like you always develop, like as you get older, different things become funny, and
yeah,
it's just great.
The thing I'll mention this, and I'll throw it to you because I want to know what you're up to. But the thing that I noticed specifically this year, was that when he's laying in bed with his wife after putting the Christmas tree up, he's got sap on his hands. I never understood why his hands were sticking to the magazine,
but then her hair and his lamp.
It kills me every time. That movie is so good. But that has been my holiday festivities so far. What about you? What are you and Tiffany and Maverick doing to ring in the season?
We've been watching the usual Christmas movies. I mean, having a great time with kind of that. Tiffany's birthday was yesterday as we record this. So we went and did like the drive-through lights show at Retama Park, which is the local horse racing venue. And just had a great time. Bought her some new cowboy boots, and that's been a lot of fun. We just watched the first time in two different nights, the two Christmas Chronicles movies, which are actually phenomenal films for recently made Christmas movies. Over the weekend, we're going to be watching the Klaus movie, which you and Megan have to watch. I'm begging you.
Oh, yeah. We really, that's on our list. We want to watch it. At least Megan and I get kind of panicked about like, oh, we've got to watch all the staples so that we don't miss anything by the time the season ends. So But we'll get around.
Even if you have to watch it like on December 26th, like it is we can
squeeze one in.
Great film. So we're going to watch that this weekend. Like it's the one thing on the calendar that we have to do this weekend.
Because we
love it so much. For me, I'm making kind of an unscheduled trip to Atlanta. So I'm leaving in the morning to go hang out with a couple of my work buddies for one day to celebrate one of my friends who got promoted. That's going to be a lot of fun, and I will be braving the airports during the holiday travel season for a 1 day trip, literally going out there and then coming back the next morning. So that's going to be fun.
I don't envy you.
I'm going to try not to leave any kids at home or anything. Like we've got Tiffany lined up to take care of Maverick.
Yeah. Well, hopefully if you leave Maverick at home, Tiffany is there. I would think that's another one that we watched this week is Home Alone, and man, I'm Megan and I were talking about it the other day. I'm continually impressed at what a good movie Home Alone is. Like the stunt work alone,
let alone the
music. Yeah, it's so good. We've already talked about Home Alone. I don't want to wax ad nauseum about it.
What I'm pretty sure we didn't say, and I've since watched both of them since we talked about it, is the second one's the better film in my approximation. Like I enjoy Tim Curry as a bad guy more.
Oh man.
I enjoy that whole thing, and the Carol of the Bells in that the second one is so good. But
don't forget Rob Schneider.
And Rob Schneider
also makes an appearance.
That was his first feature film, Rob Schneider's.
Was it really? That was
the film debut of Rob Schneider. So,
oh man, that's too funny.
But yeah, no, such a good movie. Both of them are. But as we said, I just rewatched it, and I definitely identify more and more with the parents. And I think Kevin needed an attitude adjustment pretty severely.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
As a little kid, I loved Kevin. Now I'm like, Kevin.
Yeah, my wife, who is a school teacher of first graders, said, like, I cannot imagine what a nightmare he must be at school. Because if that's how he treats invaders of his home, you can only imagine what he's going to do to a school teacher that makes him angry.
Yeah, well, if that's how he treats his mother, imagine how he treats a school teacher. But
yeah,
phenomenal film. And Joe Pesci knocking it out of the park in a PG rated film. So
yeah, we got to give him credit for just holding back on all the F bombs,
toning himself down.
You know, if there had been a Martin Scorsese directed cut of Home Alone, it would be, it'd be unwatchable, but B, the language would be blue, shall we say.
Imagine Kevin McAllister as the head of Casino in the Casino film.
Oh man.
No. Phenomenal films. So now I'm ready to get on to this week's topic, if you are.
Nice. Yeah, let's do it.
All right, Chris. So now we get to talk about this week's subject matter, which is the best Christmas carols, Christmas hymns, whatever comes to mind. I believe we both put together lists of 10.
Yes.
We can kind of lightning round this if you want. We don't have to spend as much time as we have on each one. Kind of want to plan on lightning rounding the first five and then spending more time talking about the top five, if that's cool with you.
Absolutely. Sounds good to me.
All right. I will say from my list, I picked a lot of more traditional Christmas hymns, a lot of songs that were written, you know, about the time the United States was founded as a nation. Which means everybody and their brother has recorded themselves singing it at some point in history.
Oh, yes.
And so for me, my methodology was a little bit different than in past, where I was looking for the right version or the right person, and instead was looking at, I enjoy this version, but really I care about the song and not necessarily the artist I put on my list. It's a good version, but it might not be my favorite because I care more about the song than anything else. And that's especially true in my bottom five as we go into it. But let's start with yours, and let's hear what your number 10 is.
So my number 10 is a song that I discovered recently over the past couple of years called Mary's Boy Child. And this is one instance where the recording was important to me because I heard the Harry Belafonte version. And Belafonte, of course, has a velvety, smooth voice. But this song I really like because it was composed for the melody was actually composed by a guy who was writing the melody as a birthday song for some friends in the West Indies. And so it's got kind of a calypso rhythm and feel. And then it got turned into a Christmas song because somebody else asked, you know, the guy who wrote the tune. Let me find his name real quick. You said lightning round, and you know that's impossible for me.
I set you up Jester, for failure.
Yeah, you did. Jester Hairston is his name. But anyway, it's a beautiful tune. It's got kind of idiosyncratic language. Let's see if I can find it in the lyrics that I think is just kind of charming. Long time ago in Bethlehem, so the Holy Bible say, Mary's boy child, Jesus Christ, was born on Christmas Day. You know, it's got a vernacular from somewhere else, but the melody is really sweet and lilting, and I just really like it. It's one that I hope people check out and hear because it's kind of unknown, and it's simple and beautiful, and I love it. So what about you? What is your number 10?
For me, I picked Josh Groban and Faith Hill's duet of The First Noel. The First Noel is, you know, bordering on ancient. I believe it was written in 1823 when it first appeared in a Cornish hymn book. So it's of English origin. And it's just a beautiful song. And it's one of those things that I remember singing a lot as a kid in churches. And it's one of those just all-time classics that even as Christmas music kind of gets annoying to me over a period of time, it's one that I can still listen to and be happy to listen to no matter who's re-recorded it or dubbed it. So that's what I'll say about that. Let's try your ninth one.
So my ninth one is, it's got a Latin title. In Dulci or Dulci, I'm not sure. In Dulci, Jubilo. It sounds like I don't actually know anything about it. But it's got a beautiful tune, and the lyrics kind of go back and forth between Latin and English. And I don't know. I have a lot of old songs on this list that are performed by British choirs. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. I like the melody as well. A lot of the melodies of the ones that I picked are kind of, I think, melodies that catch a musician's ear because they kind of go all over the place and they're really active. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It's one that I usually get stuck in my head every year as well, which most of these do. But yeah, that's my number 9. What about you?
Well, before we go to that, Call Me Sheltered, but I had never heard this song or realized I'd heard this song until it was on your list a week ago, and I've been mesmerized by it. It's a beautiful song, so definitely worth having.
A lot of, like I said, a lot of mine come from old CDs of like the Cambridge College Choir or whatever that my dad and my grandfather had. And so I've been listening to these old obscure Christmas songs for years.
Nice. Okay. So for my ninth, it's Angels We Have Heard on High. And I put For King and Country's version because it's just got a really cool instrumental breakdown in the middle of it. And it's enjoyable. Angels We Have Heard on High is another one of those Christian hymns. It's based on Luke 2, verses 8 through 15. It was written in 1862. It's unknown origin for the lyrics, but James Chadwick appended it to music in the 1860s. One thing that's cool about it is it was written in 7/7 time, which is kind of an interesting one for like the Church of Christ people to be around. So
yeah,
it's just a great song too. So I've always loved it and the chorus for this song. So it made it the list at number 9 for me. Let's talk about your number 9.
So another old carol.
Sorry, you're number 8.
Yeah. Number 8, number 9. You got Beatles on the brain from our episode on the White Album.
Don't make me talk about that stupid song again. Revolution, number 9.
Number 9. Anyway, Sussex Carol. This is another one. There are a lot of them on my list from the choir of King's College at Cambridge. And it's just another melody that I find really striking. I don't know if maybe when you edit this one, you can put some of the audio in. But it's a really, this one is really joyful, as all good Christmas carols should be. But it's also in kind of I want to say it's like in 6/8, you know, almost kind of a waltzy sort of feel. But some of the lyrics: on Christmas night, all Christians sing to hear the news the angels bring. News of great joy, news of great mirth, news of our merciful King's birth. I just find it really, I don't know. A lot of these, I'm going to be saying some of the same things. It's enchanting. It's magical. Because I think, you know, for us as Christians, Jesus coming and the salvation that follows from that should be really joyful. And so, like any of these, like old. Also, there's definitely an element that has almost nothing to do with the birth of Christ and more to do with imagining that I'm in a castle somewhere. And, you know, there's a giant hall where they're bringing in like a pig with an apple in its mouth and like mead and holly everywhere. Like some of it, I have to admit, does have a little bit more to do with the more fantastical elements of Christmas, I think. But that is my number 8. What about you? What's your number 8?
So I'm going to say number 8 is Joy to the World, first of all. It's another one of those just really, really great classic hymns. It was written in the early 1700s by Isaac Watts, who wrote a ton of hymn music that you hear and sing today in churches if you're using a classic hymnal. His fingerprints are all over early hymn writing. Joy to the World's tune, though, changed in the 1800s by a guy named Lowry, I believe, to the tune that you and I know today. And it's just a really, really great song. Kind of to your point before, it's so joyful and so forward-looking and talking about celebrating in a way that normally you don't generally think about throughout the course of the year. And the version that I've put on my list is kind of against my normal rules of operation. And that is, I took a modern Christian artist, Chris Tomlin, and I didn't take the true version of his hymn. I took the version of his version that he recorded, which is Joy to the World, Unspeakable Joy.
Yeah.
Which probably is one of the best classic hymn / modern song mashups ever created in my mind, as far as the Christian world of music goes, where you've taken something that's old and familiar and everybody knows and taken a new spin on it and not cheapened the original version and not made the original version. You know, there's a lot of just ham-fisted versions of taking something old and turning it into something new, and it just isn't good. Joy to the World, Unspeakable Joy is a phenomenal song as a standalone song. So the hymn I picked is Joy to the World, and the version on my list is Chris Tomlin's.
So I've actually played Chris Tomlin's version of the song for Christmas services at my church when I was in the worship band. And it really is one of the few where he took the time to try and stay in the spirit of the lyrics and compose something with a melody and lyrics that hold up or like stand up to the original.
Stand toe-to-toe with the originals.
And it's kind of a rocking tune.
It really is.
It was, I remember it being a lot of fun to play, which is not something you can say of a lot of church music as an electric guitarist who just wants to like shred the blues all day. Like it's a lot of fun.
And not to derail us too far. I mean, Chris Tomlin is one of those musicians who I don't think is indicative of what's wrong with CCM in general. Like, I feel like he's a good, you know, he's a good ambassador for the genre in general. But this is one of the songs that you don't even think about him as an ambassador for CCM. He's just doing a good job here.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Number seven for you. I'm interested in hearing, what you got.
Okay. This one, you know, we've been talking about like mirth and merriment. This one is probably the most like cheerful, joyful song on this list. It's called Ding Dong Merrily on High. And it's got one of those recurring musical hooks that like, it's kind of funny that churches would sing this together because it's a really long, the words are simple: Gloria, Hosanna in excelsis. But Gloria lasts for like three or four measures. It's one of those where it starts way up high, Gloria, Hosanna in excelsis. It's really long, and so it's comical to me, like, that somebody composed that and went like, yeah, congregations will sing that because like nobody has the chops for that. You know, I barely do. And I consider myself somewhat of a musician. But you know, there's a lot of sensory sort of stuff in the words of the song. Ding dong merrily on high, in heaven the bells are ringing. Ding dong, verily the sky is riven with angels singing. It's just a lot of, I don't know, just kind of a lot of revelry in, you know, such a joyous, such a happy occasion, as the guy from Monty Python and the Holy Grail would say. And so that's another one that's like super obscure that I don't know anybody else who knows it, but like me and my weird family. But it's a lot of fun. There's a slight sub theme of bells in my list, but we'll get to that eventually. But that's the story on Ding Dong Merrily on High. Are we at your seven or your six?
My seven.
Okay.
So to continue the idea of bells, my seventh is Carol of the Bells, nice. Which is just a wonderfully just genuinely great piece of music. It was written in 1914 by a Ukrainian, and I'm going to totally botch his name here. I had to pull it up to make sure I had it in front of me, and it's Mykola Lenovtovich.
No kidding.
And it wasn't translated into English until the Depression era, 1929-1930.
Oh, wow.
But it was originally meant to be bells and a cappella voices, and it was recorded in Kiev for the first time in 1916, 1917. But everybody knows the Carol of the Bells. Everybody's heard it. It's in every Christmas movie you've ever seen. It's just a wonderful song. And the lyrics for it are great too, kind of on their own. You and I have talked about Home Alone ad nauseum, and it's probably the song that makes Home Alone what it is John Williams playing Carol of the Bells. Made the list. Here we go.
Yeah, it's that is one that's fantastic, and a lot of musicians have covered it, and it seems to be hard to mess that song up. It's so good. You know, there are plenty of dud versions of some of the songs on our list, but Carol of the Bells is definitely one that I don't skip to a different dial on the radio, have, you know, being irritated with how much it's on the radio. I always let this one play.
So first off, it's a 4-part harmony for voices plus bells. It's in 3/4 time, and it's based on a 4-note repeating theme. So it's really hard to mess up. Like, talk about a simple, just from a music perspective, you can't really botch that if you can keep basic time.
And that's the thing that I think makes it a lot of fun, is because it almost turns into a round depending on the arrangement that you're listening to. And it's like, I don't know, if there's any Christmas oriented argument for keep it simple, stupid, it kind of is this song, because it repeats and builds in intensity. And it's just that I was glad to see that on your list, because it's not on mine. It's really good.
Well, now we're to number 6 on your list. Let's hear. Oh, and by the way, I tried really hard not to put anything that was on your list, because I feel like we're shorting our listeners when there's a double up and we're just done. So I went through this like, okay, no, I can't have that.
Nobody wants to hear both of us say the same 10 songs just by like 10 different or 20 different musicians. That's
the judges were unanimous, folks.
Yeah, no. Then again, the Two Dudes and Tunes promise is that you get what you pay for. So,
all right. So now let's talk about your number 6.
So keeping the bell train rolling. This is another instance where I've heard this song a million times and couldn't really find a version that stuck out to me. So I just picked a version by somebody that I like. But the song is I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day by Johnny Cash. And this is a really moving song. It's a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And it's really kind of a sad, not to bring it down. You know me, I'm always on the sad train when it comes to albums and songs that we talk about here on Two Dudes and Tunes. But around the time of the Civil War, or shortly before it, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's wife perished in a house fire. And some of the research I was doing said that the reason he started growing his long beard is because of the scars he had from burns trying to save his wife. But coming out of that, and then shortly on the heels of that, his eldest son, without Longfellow's blessing, joined the Union Army in the Civil War, because, you know, like a lot of young men, he just felt that it was his duty to participate in that. And so there are lyrics in the song that have to do with his son leaving, and I'm going to look him up, because he's really wrestling with how can this message of peace on earth be when, you know, such a terrible conflict is rending the nation in two. So the lyrics that don't really make it into any of the recorded versions of this, but that are part of the original poem, read like this. Then from each black accursed mouth, the cannon thundered in the south, and with the sound, the carols drowned of peace on earth, goodwill to men. It was as if an earthquake rent the hearthstones of a continent and made forlorn the households born of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And so he kind of bemoans the state of the world, but then at the very last of the song, the final verses, then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. And this song, in addition to, you know, just being kind of, it has always been kind of moving to me. There are two different melodies to this song. One kind of earlier, more obscure melody that I think is more common in England. And then the American one that you hear most American artists play, like Johnny Cash sang that melody. A lot of people sing that melody. But it's just a very, it's one of the few times where sad and Christmas mix, and I think it's kind of meaningful. You know, there are a lot of really mopey, you know, like Last Christmas I Gave You My Heart kind of things. But I've always loved this song for the words primarily, and the melody and the people who sing it kind of secondarily. That is my number six. What about yours?
I picked Away in a Manger, and I picked Martina McBride's version for this particular one. Away in a Manger is one of those songs that if you're around any sort of passionate group of people for very long, they'll fall into two camps. And just like with anything that's theologically based, those camps will get really angry with each other on the fly of the moment. It is believed currently that Away in the Manger is a 100% American hymn, that it was written in the U.S. in the 1840s-ish. But sometime in the 1880s, the Universalist, which was a big magazine for Protestant reformers, published that it was based on a poem written by Martin Luther, the great reformer, with no attribution or no proof of that. But it has continued on to today. And so there's a group of people who believe that Away in a Manger, you know, to the point that they call Away in a Manger Luther's cradle song. Versus Away in a Manger. Whole scholarly dissertations have been done to either support or refute that from different PhDs over the years. Like, it's crazy how much people fight over this song.
Yeah.
It is also a living song. It's kind of interesting. I didn't realize this. I grew up singing the version that was published by Murray in the 1880s, but a whole nother group of people in the United States sing a completely different, not completely different, but a structurally different song with different lyrics. And throughout the years, there's been a third verse, there hasn't been a third verse, lines have changed, things have been updated. And so kind of reading through the Wikipedia article for this song was kind of mind blowing to be like, oh shoot, like I can see how people would get this or that or hear different things than what I've heard, because it's published different ways in different parts of the world. But regardless of that, it's one of those songs that has an absolutely gorgeous melody. It's very contemplative. It's very quiet. And there's something about music that stops me in my tracks when it's making me stop and think or be contemplative about what's going on. And it's a picture. It's a song that paints a picture with the words and the lyrics. So you feel like you're there watching, you know, the new baby Christ. And that's just one of those things that just, it's always touched me. Even as a little kid, it captivated me. So that's my number six. Not so much the Martina McBride version, but she has a very good version of it out there. And so it's entertaining to listen to. So now we've made it to the top five. What do you have for your number five, Chris?
So I went a little, I don't want to say non-traditional, but I chose the song Every Valley from Handel's Messiah. Handel's Messiah, if y'all don't know, is the... is a collection of works by Handel, Handel's Messiah, and the text of which is largely taken from a lot of the prophetic writing about the coming of Christ in Isaiah. And Every Valley specifically, I love because the music is is exciting and triumphant and exultant and all those things. But the music, the melody of the song does exactly what the lyrics say. Mm-hmm. So like, when the singer sings and every hill made low, the melody goes low. You know, there are bits in this movement where the singer sings about the rough places being made plain. The melody levels out and stays kind of the same. And it's a really fantastic, I'm going to get the choral position wrong, but whoever, you know, I think it's usually like a tenor that sings it. And there's one specific version that I listened to with the, you know, the London Philharmonic or whoever it is. Let's see. Performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, and Mark Padmore is the vocalist. And he has a voice like fit to bring the house down. You know, this really brassy and bold voice singing about the coming of Christ and singing scripture. Like, that's what part of what I think for me makes Handel's Messiah so powerful is, you know, George Friedrich Handel didn't write any of the words. It's all stuff lifted directly from scripture. And it's just really exciting. Even as a kid, the Messiah was one of those things that we would always have on in the house during Christmas time, probably at my insistence, because I was an annoying little kid and wanted to listen to the same three or four albums over
again,
and over
again.
But man, listeners, if you get a chance, sit down and listen to a really good recording of Handel's Messiah, because it's really moving and specifically Every Valley is like a really enjoyable piece of music, in addition to kind of the image painting that the words and the lyrics do. So that is my number five slot. What about you? What's your number five tune?
The audience is going to throw pitchforks at me because coming in at number five is not technically a Christmas tune. It's a New Year's tune, but the two holidays kind of bridge together for me because as a little kid, we always went to my grandparents' house in Brownfield, Texas. And so we'd get there, you know, the 21st or 22nd, and we'd stay through the new year. And so those two holidays kind of bookended a trip to my grandparents' house every year. So enough about it. Let's talk about the song itself. It's Auld Lang Syne, or however you want to say it.
If you're from Texas, it's Auld Lang Syne.
Yeah, exactly.
I have said it every time I've ever said the title of that song.
Auld Lang Syne is a Scots hymn, if you will, to ring in the ending of something and the beginning of something new. And it's bidding goodbye to the old and hello to the new. So it's a traditional New Year's folk song. It was committed to paper by Robert Burns in 1788, but when he first published it, he admitted that it's a song of the old people who predated him. And there are other bits and pieces of it that have been found in writings as early as like the 1480s, and that he committed the poem down to, you know, the common lexicon in 1788, I believe. And in 1789, it was put to music by James Watson for the first time. Or sorry, no, it was published. The original like portions of the poem were published in 1711 by James Watson, which Robert Burns then built off of. It was put to music a couple of years after Robert Burns published it, and is one of those songs that has just endured for forever. Everybody's sang it. Everybody's done some version of it. And it's a really kind of rhetorical format for a question. I mean, it asks the question, should old times be forgotten as you move forward? And the answer, of course, is no, you don't want to forget the past. And it's just a great song. It's had very few changes since it was originally brought around. And everybody knows the melody. Everybody knows the nature of the song. The melody is attributed to a musician called William Shield, who was a contemporary and bounced ideas off of the likes of like Beethoven and Haydn. And this was a song that they kind of workshopped together the melody on. So it's kind of interesting to hear that there was that kind of collaboration going on in the 1780s, 1790s among just people that we revere for being musical geniuses. And to this day, something that they've created together persists courtesy of Robert Burns, who is probably one of my favorite Scots poets ever. I had to read a bunch of his work when I was in college, and he just really stuck with me. And this song has always kind of been the traditional end of the holidays for me. It signifies the beginning of the new year. And I love this song. So it made the cut for me as a Christmas carol that probably doesn't count, but whatever.
It makes an appearance in maybe my favorite Christmas film ever. At the very end of, no, not in White Christmas.
Oh, really?
At the very end of It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
When George Bailey's wife has come to his rescue and dragged literally everybody and their mom out of bed to donate money to him, all the money from the building and loan that he lost. He didn't lose it. His crazy uncle lost it. But isn't it the
tune that's playing in the background song when the daughter says, "Look, father, every time teacher says."
Yeah, every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings. But your note about, should we forget or have antipathy towards the times that we've had is kind of the theme of that film. Mm-hmm. George Bailey is continuously wrestling with, why is this my lot in life? Why have the things that I've done put me in a position where I had to give up, getting on a tramp steamer and sailing around the world or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to pay more attention to that song. That's a song that I never felt one way or the other about. But now it's definitely something that is going to make me sit up and take notice, because it made it so high up on your list, and it does have more meaning. I just kind of think of it as like everybody sings it while they're drunk at the end of the old year, yeah, beginning of the new. So that's really neat. I'm glad you put it on your list.
It's a song too that has had more meaning to me as I've grown older. I've become a huge fan of finding really old recordings of events that happened in the past. And there's some audio recordings from like 1918, when the ceasefire of World War I happened, and you've got the German army and the American and British army all singing Auld Lang Syne all at the same time. And it's a terrible audio quality, but to hear something from 103 years ago and people from all sides of a battlefield that just, minutes before were, killing each other, singing the same song. It's, mm-hmm, there's things about that are just really powerful to me. And this, absolutely, is one of those songs. The version I put on the playlist actually is the Irish Rovers, and it's done kind of in the jaunty Irish drinking kind of at the pub, finishing up the year kind of thing, to your point. But it's a phenomenal song, and the words are phenomenal, and it's one that holds a special place in my heart. So that was my number five. You ready to talk about your number four?
Yes. This is one. There are so many great Christmas carols. I almost put this at number one, but by the time I finished making my list, I realized there were three others that had to go ahead of it. So the name of this tune is the Sands Day Holly Carol. And this song I first heard from one of those old weird albums that my dad had, from this album called Sing We Now of Christmas by the Christmas Revels. And I'm not a music historian, but the vibe of this record is definitely some musician and music historian got together a bunch of musicians who could play medieval instruments and went and dug up a bunch of medieval Christmas tunes. And so the recording of this one is just, I mean, you were talking about drinking songs. The recording of this song is a choir, a guy who sort of sings the verses, and somebody playing like a concertina or some other sort of squeeze box instrument. And it's a really like beautiful melody. Sounds kind of like something you would sing in a tavern. And the lyrics, I'm about to just kind of make this up from the top of my head because I'm not sure, but the lyrics have every like earmark to me of being something that you would write to kind of teach your kids or to teach the lay people some of the like key foundational theological points, because each verse talks about the color of a holly berry, not Halle Berry of X-Men fame, but a berry from the holly bush or whatever it is. And relates that to kind of a biblical truth. So like verse one, now the holly bears a berry as white as the silk, and Mary bore Jesus all wrapped up in silk. So this idea of, you know, the berry's whiteness kind of representing the baby Jesus being wrapped up in silk, and also possibly Mary being pure, being a virgin, giving birth to Jesus, you know, through virgin birth. And the second verse, now the holly bears a berry as green as the grass, and Mary bore Jesus who died on the cross. This one, the like kind of tie-in is not quite as evident. And I imagine if you have an accent, maybe grass and cross rhyme. But the third and fourth verses, it's much more apparent. Now the holly bears a berry as black as the coal, and Mary bore Jesus who died for us all. So this idea of blackness, you know, of course, being a color associated with mourning, is kind of a thing to remind you that Jesus died. And the final verse, now the holly bears a berry as blood is it red, and Mary bore Jesus who rose from the dead. So another kind of image of Jesus dying and being risen again after 3 days. I have always liked the symbolism, and the melody really does sound like a drinking song. Like if you were going to drink to any song on my list, it would be this one. And there's a part in kind of the hook where the words are just people singing the word holly, and it kind of slows down. I'm sure you've heard those sort of drinking songs where the words kind of slow down for a little bit and then pick back up and you're back into the melody. It's really a lot of fun. And so that is my number four, is a Christmas song that you can drink to, the Sans Day Holly Carol, or just called the Sans Day Carol occasionally. But yeah, that's mine. What about yours? Can we drink to your number four? I think we kind of can. Ours have oddly sort of lined up thematically almost throughout this list.
Good Christmas carols can be drank too. Yes. As long as it's nog in your cup, we're good to go.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So my number four is God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, because I believe in the old English version, not the 1960s reappropriation of it. Yeah. God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. Funny thing, I was listening to different versions. This is one of those covered by everybody kind of tunes. And the one that I just absolutely fell in love with and had never listened to and added to the list is the version recorded by Sarah McLachlan, who I don't necessarily like as an artist, but it's a duet with the Bare Naked Ladies, and it's phenomenal. So good.
I was really excited you put this on your list because A, it's one of my favorites, but B, this version has been playing on our, like, the radio station that goes, like, all Christmas till Christmas here in Lubbock. And I heard it, and I was like, who is this? And I looked at the little, like, scrolling marquee on my radio. It's the Bare Naked Ladies, but it's so good. It's a lot of fun.
Very good. This is a song that's based on a poem that was set to music in the 1650s. And then it first became part of like a hymnal in 1760 when it was printed in broadsheet by the Monthly Review. It's of Catholic origin, but was quickly adopted by the Anglican Church in Britain about the same time. And this is one of those songs that as I read more about it, I mean, I love the lyrics. I grew up listening to it in church and singing it and listening to the choir sing it and the bells accompaniment and all of that. But as I read about this song, I found myself laughing because this song seems like Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, but the like 1700s version of that. Like people loved this song and they hated this song. And so in the early in the 1800s, there was a parody version of this song written by William Hone with parody lyrics that are actually too profane even for this podcast 120 years later or 200 years later in this case. An article, I have to read this to you, in an article of the March of 1824 issue of The Gentleman's Magazine, complained that in London, no Christmas carols are heard except that some croaking ballad singer bawling out, "God rest you merry gentlemen," or like some droggle. The carol is also referred to in Dickens' 1843 novella, A Christmas Carol. And it's also quoted in George Eliot's 1861 novel, Silas Marner, which if you haven't read it, it is phenomenal. That's another kind of off the beaten path, old English novel that's worth reading.
Oh man. Another book.
Another book for the pile.
Yeah, exactly. I love that you picked this song, not only because I love it, but my uncle sent me something hilarious the other day that I will send you a link to. This guy on Twitter who goes by Ramses the Pigeon wrote.
I already like him.
He wrote a parody of this song where he sang all the parts and, you know, did rhythm by like stomping and clapping and hitting himself in the face at one point. But it's about the debate about where the comma should go in God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. And it is really funny. I'll send it to you because you'll get a kick out of it. Maybe you can put it in the show notes. But for the record, from at least what he says in the song, and this guy seems to be a musicologist, you know, serious type guy. It goes after Mary. God rest ye merry, gentlemen. So like, go rest and relax and celebrate, gentlemen, you know, being the message of Christmas and stuff. But anyway, I'll have to send that to you because the parody is really funny. I guess this song just kind of lends itself to parody, be it good, bad, or ugly.
Well, it's just a great song. You know, this is one of those songs, it's in 8-6 time. And so it's 8-6, 8-6, 8-6 with refrain. So it's got just a fun little jaunty, it is a good, you know, shake your arm and...
It's in a minor key too, which is really funny for such a like joyful tune. It's proof that minor and major don't have anything to do with happy or sad, depending on how you write the song.
Yeah. And you have to think some of that has to be due to like the acoustics in like stone churches that were built in the Dark Ages and trying to get something that boomed out and resonated throughout the whole village or whatever, because the men could actually do something in a minor key that would stand out. But it's so great. It is great. So it's one of those songs I really love listening to all the time. So now we've come to number three for you.
All right. So my number three is O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. And the version I picked is the version by a kind of a Christian, I hesitate to call them a prog rock band, but they're kind of a Christian prog rock band, this band called Future of Forestry. And I first heard about this version of this song in college because we played it for a chapel service, if I'm not mistaken. I actually discovered this, you know, compiling this list, I knew that O Come, O Come, Emmanuel was going to be on there because the words are just so profound. The second verse, which, you know, if you're in a Church of Christ tradition, you always wind up skipping a verse. And the second verse is one that I feel like gets missed. O come, thou rod of Jesse, free thine own from Satan's tyranny, from the depths of hell thy people save, and give them victory o'er the grave. It's just got such striking words. Disperse the gloomy clouds of night and death's dark shadows put to flight. And this is another one that this is in a minor key and feels like it's in a minor key. It's definitely just kind of a very somber, earnest crying out of, you know, for the return of Christ. Well, I guess, you know, when it was written, it was more talking about, you know, his first coming, which is what Christmas is about. But I've always just loved the words, and then just such a like somber melody. And the Future of Forestry version adds a little bit of like rock and roll prog guitar intensity. There's a lot of like complexity to the parts that they interject in between all the words that you and I would recognize. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really good tune. Once again, of course, it probably goes without saying, we recommend all these songs to y'all as you're listening to this, but I thoroughly enjoyed this specific version of O Come Emmanuel.
It's a great song and it's a great version. I absolutely love this song, and to kind of keep on the O Come trajectory. My number three is O Come All Ye Faithful. And I picked the venerable Nat King Cole's version. He's amazing. We've talked about him before as just being a superstar among all other people. O Come All Ye Faithful is one of those tracks that just, it means a lot to me personally. I actually grew up singing this in the original Latin, which makes me sound really really pompous or whatever, but I actually knew this song as Adeste Fidelis before I knew it was O Come All Ye Faithful.
Nice.
It's a Christmas carol attributed to various authors. It was first published in 1744. It's been attributed to everybody from John Francis Wade to John Reading to King John the Fourth of Portugal to a bunch of Cistercian monks. It's been around for a long time and nobody will ever figure out, but basically it was first published in 1751, and it, in the typical like proto-Catholic hymnal or whatever, it was 8 verses long originally, published entirely in Latin, and it's essentially an entire mass in one song. And it's just absolutely gorgeous. I learned it as Adeste Fidelis as a kid, and then, of course, you know, shortly after, learned it as O Come All Ye Faithful, and it's just a wonderful song. I mean, O Come All Ye Faithful, joyful and triumphant, O come ye to Bethlehem, come and behold him, born the King of Angels, O come let us adore him, O come let us adore him, come let us adore him, Christ the Lord. And it goes on for, you know, 7 more verses, but it's one of those songs I know every word to in English and Latin, and I just, it's a gorgeous song. It's been performed by everybody. Nat King Cole only does 4 verses, I believe. I'm pulling that off the top of my head. I haven't listened to it in a while, but it's a great song, and the music is wonderful. And it's another one of those songs that's tops you in your tracks. It causes you to stop and think about the imagery that's being laid out in front of you.
Yeah.
And it's something that I don't know how familiar you are with it, but it's just one of those that it puts me in the Christmas mood. When I hear that song, it puts me in the right mindset for Christmas. And a lot of that we have to be thankful to. It was translated into English by the Duke of Leeds, I believe it was, with the help of Frederick Oakley. And It's just, it's so good. I'm at a loss for words because I'm in the mood of it right now. And
so I am so glad that you put this on your list. I actually heard a version of it this morning on the radio by Luther Vandross.
Oh,
and it's so great because he slows it down a little bit, but not like a slow jam. It's like a triumphant procession.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a almost like a militaristic kind of snare mm-hmm. behind his version. And you know, it's Luther Vandross, so mm-hmm. vocally it's just like a 15 out of 10. It's so good. But yeah, the melody of this song just keeps going up and up and up and up. And it sounds like a horn cadence or like a uh-huh. trumpet call.
Uh-huh.
It's really, this song is so like, it really is exciting and kind of intoxicating because it does just sort of like the melody and the words just sort of bring you into that. Like it's a really great tune to play for like a worship service
uh-huh.
because you know, when you're planning out a worship service, you kind of think about like, how are we going to bring people into the space in this time where they're going to worship the Lord? How are we going to like, this is like a good tone setter.
Yeah.
Because the words are literally, oh, come, let us adore him.
Yep.
And you sing it over and over and over again. And it's, this is an excellent song. And I'm really glad that you put it on there. I will say for my part, the one hang up I have with the song sometimes is hearing people like Nat King Cole and Bing Crosby sing in the worst Latin that anybody has ever committed to tape. Like, it's a good thing that those two guys can sing fit to beat the band mm-hmm. because boy is there. And like Nat King Cole's German, whenever he sings O Tannenbaum is another song that I'm just like, oh,
tell me like, you don't speak German without speaking any German.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And if it were anybody else singing it, it would be nails on a chalkboard. But thankfully, it's Nat King Cole. But even so, I find the bad Latin kind of charming. So I'm glad that this made it onto your list.
We're getting down there into the final stretch, man. Tell me about the number two ranked song on your list.
So number two for me is Once in Royal David's City.
It's a great song.
And this is another one that I feel like people don't really know about that much, unless I guess you're in, you know, if you're in a church going tradition, even you might not have heard of it. But specifically the version by Choir of King's College in Cambridge, because that recording features like, it's a large boys choir,
mm-hmm.
Not a choir for large boys, but a choir full of many boys singing. And the melody of this song is really, really delicate and really goes kind of all over the place. It's another song that kind of starts in a lower register and really goes up and peaks. But their arrangement specifically calls to mind for me all the times I've ever been in an area full of new fallen snow
mm-hmm.
that is just as quiet as it can possibly be. And you know, I have read things that suggest that Jesus was born like during the summer or the spring or whatever, you know, like Christmas is in December for a whole host of reasons that have probably next to nothing to do with him actually being born in, you know, what we in kind of the European tradition think of as like somewhere in the Alps, you know, in this, you know, farmer shack. But it's just a really beautiful, peaceful song. And the words, but the words are really, just kind of simple poetry. Once in Royal David's City stood a lowly cattle shed. There a mother laid her baby in a manger for his bed. Mary was that mother mild, Jesus Christ, her little child. He came down to earth from heaven, who is God and Lord of all, and his shelter was a stable, and his cradle was a stall, with the poor, oppressed, and holy, lived on earth, our Savior holy. It's another one of those songs that I feel like you almost just need to listen to it to understand, or we need to have some sort of audio cue kind of explaining just how good the music is.
Mm-hmm.
The author for this is an Irish poet, Cecil Francis Alexander, who penned All Things Bright and Beautiful, which is another really gorgeous hymn that I grew up singing in different Church of Christ churches that we would go to. So that is my number two song. It was actually the first song I put on this list because I knew that this was going to need to be on here for me.
Oh, that's a great one, man. I'm really glad to see it on your list. For me, my number two is also the first song I put on my list, and I knew it was going to be right at the top when I put it down. And this is a song that up until recently has been fairly obscure to most people. So I felt like the in crowd when people started talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, I know that song really well. And that's,
I was into it before it was cool.
I was a total hipster. I was never a hipster. I was never one of those typewriter carrying losers in skinny jeans before they were cool. But for me, this song is one of those songs I've known since my early teenage years. And that is In the Bleak Midwinter. In particular, In the Bleak Midwinter, as composed by Gustav Holst, the greatest composer of all time, who we've talked about ad nauseum.
Show alumni.
The version I have on my list is performed by the Worcester Cathedral Choir. This is a song that the poem that it is set to was originally written by Christina Rossetti, which... cool to have a woman poet make the list, because I feel like, especially with like Christmas carols that were written in the 1800s, they skew very male dominated. So to see something, you know, that was first published in 1872 as a Christmas carol poem by Christina Rossetti, and then over the years, it's been put to music by a couple of different people, but the version that I'm most familiar with is Gustav Holst, who composed and put it to music in 1906, and it was published in the English Hymnal and sung throughout the world since then. In 1909, Harold Dark composed a version of it that's very different. Do not listen. They both have the same name, but if you listen to the Dark version of it, you will not get anywhere near the quality of music that Holst put this to. People became familiar with it in kind of the common lexicon if you're a fan of Peaky Blinders. This song is kind of a throughput song. The Holst version is commonly played in the episodes of Peaky Blinders kind of throughout the seasons to signify the season. It has come under fire for some of the theology of it over the years, but at this point I think it stands above theological concerns. People will argue about whether or not God can live in heaven versus, or that heaven can contain God or whatever their argument might be, but that just seems kind of like an asinine side story to what's really going on there.
It really kind of feels like
a cheap shot.
Point.
Yeah, it's a cheap shot, like a really great song. Musically, we've talked about Holst's The Planets on here. I think it's the greatest composition ever made and probably the single greatest contribution to what 20th century and 21st century music became. And this song is more of the same from Holst. Beautiful strings, phenomenal brass section, deep moving bass section, set to the poem, without any changes. I mean, he just took the poem and lifted it and set his music to it. And It includes verses like, our God, heaven cannot hold him, nor earth sustain. Heaven and earth shall flee away when he comes to reign. In the bleak midwinter, a stable place sufficed the Lord Almighty Jesus Christ. It's one of those songs that did not have an impact on me as a kid because I didn't hear it till I was a teenager and I was in my Holst mania years, but since then has quickly risen to the top of my list. And if it weren't for one other song that has had more of an impact on my life, this would be the number one song on my list. Rossetti has or had a phenomenal way with words and putting me in the place of Christ's birth at the time of his birth. And it's really prophetic the way she wrote it. I mean, the whole poem has, you know, here we are at Christ's birth, but here's what's to come. Here's the next thing. And then, you know, you have birth to death, and then first coming to second coming. It is really nuanced and deep. And one of the things that kind of sucks about it in some ways is the way it's recorded today. It's really hard to understand the lyrics. It's those choirs that are just too much choir to be understandable. Like, you've got to sit down with the words and really focus on what the choir is doing. But it's so good. I mean, it's so good. If you've never listened to it, you've got to stop what you're doing right now. Chris and I will wait. Just hit pause, go listen to it, and we'll be here when you get back because it's so great.
Through the magic of technology, we can wait patiently.
Exactly. We won't even be upset about it.
Yeah.
If you're looking for early recordings of this, you know, early 1920s, before Holst changed the name to In the Bleak Midwinter, which is the name of the original poem, he released this as Cranham, C-R-A-N-H-A-M. But same exact song, so...
Give that it sounds like out. What I do during the holiday season. I cram ham.
Yeah, exactly.
I had to fudge a letter of that word to make this joke.
The joke works, though. I laughed, so.
Well, I appreciate that.
What was your number one pick? Let's round this thing out and send it home, man.
So in the spirit of National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Drum roll, please.
Joy to the world.
No, actually. Oh Holy Night by Nat King Cole. Oh Holy Night is, for me, the holy grail of Christmas tunes. Depending on the singer or my mood or whatever version I'm listening to, it is known to make me tear up from time to time, just because the lyrics are so profound. The version I have on our list is Nat King Cole, because who else? You know, this is a song that I think a lot of churches give to their best singer because, you know, it does the thing where it builds and builds and builds. And, you know, the last big note where you sing night, you know, is really long. And it's usually, you know, the singer takes it up a few octaves or whatever. But it's another one that has really profound words. But this is one of those songs where, in the church tradition, you actually get to sing verse 3 instead of skipping the third verse, as so many, Church of
Play
Christ
the ones and fours, everybody.
Yeah. Oh, nothing bugs me more. It's always the third verse that has some of the most profound stuff in it. And that's always, well, we're going to skip the third verse. But anyway, verse 3 of O Holy Night: truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love, and his gospel is peace. Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease. That is the part where, if I'm in a church service or in a particularly emotional mood, I will start crying, because it's such a profound and simple explanation of what makes the gospel such a hopeful thing. That line about chains he shall break, for the slave is our brother. You know, neither slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, that kind of thing. And musically, it's just so powerful too. Like the melody really does build and build and build, and the bridge of the song, or the climax, or whatever you want to call it, is just so like so simple and so expertly written that it gets me every time. And so that's why O Holy Night is my favorite. There are any number. I'm sure that like Luciano Pavarotti probably has a version of this. Nat King Cole, Josh Groban, who has recorded every Christmas song three times, it seems, has a really great version, I'm sure. It is just an excellent Christmas tune.
It really is. And if it had not already been on your list when I looked at the listings, it would have been on mine in a heartbeat. One of those bottom six would have been just punted out the door in a heartbeat for it. So, for me, my number one holds the most sentimental memories of my childhood in my life. And because of that, it has a seat at the throne at number one for me. The song is Silent Night. The version I picked, I couldn't find one that I really liked on Spotify, honestly. So I just started listening to all sorts of different versions of it. And I finally settled on, if we're going to pick a gospel version of Silent Night, somebody who actually did a very even-keeled, good representation of it is Elvis Presley.
Oh, his version is fantastic. I heard it recently. You kept picking songs that I've heard on the radio, and I was really glad to hear it because I was like, oh, I've heard that exact version. His version is really quite good.
It is. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I love Elvis the entertainer, but Elvis the singer, songwriter, musician, whatever you want to call him, really overrated. Like, he was an entertainment, you know, megastar, but not great. But his version of Silent Night, it was pretty early in his career that he recorded it and released it. It's just phenomenal. So the reason I picked it for number one, everybody's kind of familiar with the idea. It's an old German hymn written in the early 1800s. I believe it was published by composer Franz Xaver Gruber in 1818. It's
German. Wait, hold up. Hans Gruber?
Franz, not Hans.
Oh, I thought you said Hans. I was like, what? Come on. There's no better Christmas connection.
I would have led with that if that had been the thing. It's like, this is why Die Hard is a Christmas movie.
I'm sorry I interrupted, but I could have sworn I heard Hans. Anyway,
Franz Xaver Gruber published it in 1818. It was quickly published in English and French and Spanish, all over the place. John Freeman Young, an Episcopal priest, is attributed with converting it to English for the Trinity Church of New York City and published it. And up to today, it's still the Freeman translation is the version that everybody sings today. Where was I going with this? Oh, it was originally written in Oberndorf, Germany. And there's a beautiful lighthouse that is thought to be where it was written. And so there's a plaque there, and it's just a really cool thing. It's one of those songs. It's been translated into 140 languages, but one of the coolest things to me as the fan of history that I am is Franz Xaver's Franz Xaver Gruber's original sheet music and annotated lyrics for this song are available for you to view in the Smithsonian Museum. Somebody bought them and brought them to the United States at some point in the past, and I've actually seen his original sheet music and notes for this song. It's really great. There's a photocopy of it on Wikipedia. For me, the reason this song makes number one though, is because As I said earlier, I grew up going to my grandparents' house for Christmas every year in Brownfield, Texas. And so from the time I was six to the time I was about 23 when they moved here to San Antonio, every year we'd pack up the car, we'd drive the 6.5-7 hours up there, and we'd spend 2 weeks with them. And it was my mom's vacation. It was our vacation. It was the time of the year where we just spent time with my grandparents. And we would go to their church, First Baptist of Brownfield. And they had the same kind of Christmas service or Christmas Eve service every year. And the ending of that service every year was the lights dimmed to black and everybody lit a candle in this highly flammable church. Like, talk about a terrible idea.
Old dried, old growth timber out there in Brownwood, Texas. Everybody's got a candle.
Exactly. And so there'd be, you know, 700-800 people in this church just with a candle lit up singing an a cappella version of Silent Night. And that was just magical to me as a kid. It captivated everything about Christmas in one song for me. Mm-hmm. The church sang it strictly in English. It wasn't until I was an adult that I heard the original German version set to the same tune. And it's beautiful. German is one of those languages that's very rough. It's not a beautiful language. It's a command presence language. But Silent Night in German is gorgeous. It's the right tone. It's the right message. It's the right everything. And it just works in a way that is very, very, very moving for me. There's not enough good things I can say about Silent Night. It is the Christmas carol to me. It signifies it's Christmas right now. And I remember as a little kid just, you know, blowing those candles out at the end. That was the end of service. Like, when you blew the candles out, you were dismissed. Uh-huh. And it wasn't about, we were a Christmas morning presents family, not a Christmas Eve presents family.
Same.
But it was the song that symbolized, like, all right, Christmas is really here. Like, this just got real. Uh-huh. And I cherish those memories. I hope now that I'm a father and I'm raising Maverick that I can build some sort of tradition like that for him that he looks back on and thinks, wow, that was really cool, because it was really out of the way for my parents. It was really tough on them a lot of years where they really didn't have the financial means to make that trip, but somehow they made it happen. And I know my grandparents had a lot to say about that, or a lot to do with them being able to do that in those years.
Yeah.
And they never said anything about it. They never held it over my parents' heads. They never did any of that. But it's one of those things that has taught me more now as an adult looking back on it than they will ever know. And unfortunately, you know, my grandmother passed away probably about 3 years ago now, and we're coming up on either our third or fourth Christmas without her. And it's kind of heartbreaking to listen to Silent Night and remember standing next to her with that candle and remember what was. So this is the song that makes the top of the list, not necessarily because it's a great song. It is a great song, but it's the song that has had the most meaning to me over the years. And I could listen to it 10,000 times on loop and not lose my appreciation for it. So that's what I got to say about that, in the words of Forrest Gump.
Well, that's great. That's great, man. Those memories with family. I was thinking about that, this past weekend while we decorated the tree. Like, I think part of the reason that I could only think of two or three gifts is because what I remember more than anything are, you know, the drive, you know, like when we lived in Youngstown, Ohio, the 3 or 4 day trek from Youngstown, Ohio to Abilene, Texas to visit my grandparents on my dad's side and waiting for my aunt and uncle and all my cousins to come down from Springfield, Illinois. and for us to all get together and have, we always do a Mexican food Christmas Eve dinner, with tamales and quesadillas and guac and chips and stuff. You know, like, it is the family stuff that I remember more than the Lego sets that I got, more than G.I. Joe's, and it, you know, all that stuff really pales in comparison to the time that I spent with family. And I think that music specifically, as you've just mentioned, has a way of summing up all those events and those, the time that you spend with family, way better than, you know, any present can.
Yeah.
I love that, man.
That's what the holidays are really about, you know, stopping and thinking about, you know, being grateful, A, that, you know, we have somebody who would come to save us from all the sins we have, regardless of what your belief system may be. There's something powerful in that thought. And then, you know, the family aspect, just stopping and having a moment with your family. It's one reason why I love Thanksgiving so much, is it's about family more than it is about anything else. This year, not to be on a soapbox or anything, but kind of my hope and wish as I've grown older is it's not about the stuff you get, but it's about the experiences you have with people. And so
absolutely,
I've been pretty vocal with my family about, I really don't want anything for Christmas this year. Like, if you want to do something for our son Maverick, like, go for it. But for me, I just want to be with you. I just want to do whatever. And so, you know, put whatever joke you want to put in my stocking or whatever, but like, don't make Christmas presents a thing for me, because that's not what I want it to be about. And I hope I stay true to that kind of moving forward. I hope that becomes my mentality, because right now I'm having to be really intentional about it. There are things I want. There are things but I'm like, no, that's not what I'm going to be. That's not who I'm going to be.
Yeah. And absolutely.
This has been a great conversation, man. I have looked forward to this for a couple of weeks now, and unfortunately, I've been under the weather, then you've been under the weather, then I've been under the weather, and then I've been on the road, and it's been
taken lame. Turns being sick. So this is definitely something that I have looked forward to since we discussed doing it way back in, you know, August, or whenever we figured out what we were going to do for the holidays. The Oracle is off visiting her family. Mm-hmm. We hope. I don't know what family the Oracle has. I guess Neo, if nobody else.
Hey, there's a new Matrix movie coming. We may find out.
See, we'll find out. This is the Matrix reunions, family reunions. But anyway, so what have we decided to do next week instead of whatever the Oracle would have for us otherwise?
Well, Chris, I'm a recovering Grinch, and I've had kind of my evil villain, Christmas villain, rubbing his hands together with the date circled on this. We're going to release next week's episode on Christmas Eve, which is, you know, a little bit later in the week than usual, because it's just, it's the most wonderful time of the year, and I can't wait. And that is, we're going to do another top 10 list, and it's the top 10 terrible Christmas songs, and you and I can battle over the worst of the worst.
Oh yes.
I've already staked my claim in the sand for the number one worst song, and you can't have it. So we'll talk about that next week. I'm sure
you'll have to text me and let me know, so I don't step on your feet with that.
And this, this week has been funny because I really didn't care about the versions. This is highly version specific. There are versions of the songs that I like, and there are versions that may they burn in eternal damnation.
Yes. When you look out over the cemetery, like in the Christmas Carol, there are some songs that I hope to be on some of those gravestones, because there are some earworms that are just stuck there for all the wrong reasons.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, folks, thank you for listening. I hope you've been enjoying our show. Please rate and review it. You might even hear us read your reviews and comments on the air.
Yes, and if you guys want to get in touch with us, feel free to shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com. That's all lowercase, no symbols or anything except for the at. Don't forget to hit us up on Instagram or Facebook. I will get back to you because I need something to do at work. Don't forget to tune in next week where we don our Grinch Lederhosen, if you like the Jim Carrey version. Two sizes smaller,
boys. Let's go.
and we will savage some of our least favorite Christmas songs. You guys have a Merry Christmas.